Okay, Oscar, thank you. We'll go to questions, question and answer session now. We do have a few reporters that have joined us here in person. So I'm going to ask them to ask their questions first, then we'll go to reporters who are on the phone. So I'll ask, just turn to the people in the room. Does anybody here have a question? I'll go to Spencer Chase first from AgriPulse. And Spencer, I'll repeat your question so people on the phone can hear it.
Yeah, questions for Oscar, and Bill, feel free to chime in on this as well. I mean, you talked about the import, or the increased exports, Mexico was up 17% year to date on beef, and you say they're looking for some other markets. Mm-hmm. What can potentially be lost if NAFTA renegotiation or modernization happens, and maybe U.S. agricultural products are maybe given as a negotiating tactic to get better access and to get some gains and things like manufacturing? Because that seems like that's really been the administration's priority in a lot of these talks.
Question is, what could potentially be lost through a renegotiation of NAFTA that would change our terms for agricultural exports?
Well, we expect that nothing will, we expect nothing will change, you know, if in terms of our position or trading position with Mexico. In conversation with the Mexican industry, I think we agree on that we shouldn't be using the agricultural sector as a bargain chip, let's say, in the negotiation. It's very important for the Mexican importers and for us to make sure that we are in the negotiation the agricultural sector retain the advantage that we have with NAFTA. We have zero duties right now, and it's very important to keep that same kind of arrangements, you know. And we hope that there are, or we know that there might be some areas that the Mexican would like to probably improve their situation, you know. But in general terms, we hope that nothing will change, and agriculture will still. Or the agricultural sector will still having this advantage for NAFTA or being part of NAFTA.
Yeah, I think that from our standpoint, as Oscar has indicated, we're at basically zero when it comes to beef. We've been at zero when it comes to pork. But the concerns that I have is it's hard to do beyond zero, obviously, but the concerns are that there could be an issue with auto parts, or there could be an issue with the another area, especially in the industrial complex or in some of the new things that will be added. And if there is not agreement, and we understand there's going to be urgency to get into these agreements and complete these agreements. And in that process, what's happened all too often is agriculture becomes the bargaining chip, as you say, or it becomes the leverage point. And so we would really like to see, if we're going to modernize trade agreements going forward, that there'd be a clause in all trade agreements that says that agriculture will be exempted from any retaliation or any type of actions that would impede the flow of products to individuals outside the United States that we're exporting to. And I think that other countries that are exporters would feel the same way. I think that as we apparently are going to be cutting back on our food aid programs and some of these things, what this does, it calls into question our reliability as a U.S. supplier to the world. And a lot of countries, for years, we've basically extolled the fact that the United States is a reliable supplier. And when countries cannot be self-sufficient, we've always preached you can be food secure with your trust in the United States as a major supplier of agricultural products. And when other things enter into the picture that interrupt that or disrupt that, that becomes very, very difficult. So what we would like to see, of course, is again a clause, a phrase, a sentence, or a paragraph, whatever it would take, to ensure that once we have an agreement, once we're selling to these countries, the last thing that ever would be used as a tool for diplomacy would be agriculture to be leveraged in any kind of a trade agreement or a political situation.
And the following would be, you mentioned that Mexico doesn't really want to see agriculture played with throughout the RCMP negotiation. Is that really true in Canada as well?
A follow-up is regarding Canada's position on NAFTA renegotiation. Phil, you want to take that?
Well, I think Canada, you know, we have a different set of issues with Canada. There's issues that when NAFTA was agreed to 23 years ago that were not included. I think everybody's familiar with those issues. I'm not going to go into those because it's outside of our area. But frankly, there are some things that need to be rectified in that relationship. So we see revisiting NAFTA is a very good thing. But it's how it's done. And these are two of our most important trading partners. 40% of U.S. beef and pork go to Canada and Mexico. So obviously we have a profound interest in how these negotiations occur and how they're handled. So to me, it's the how it has become very important in this relationship.
Okay. Janie Gabbett from Meeting Place has a question.
Question
is a follow-up on, is there anything to be renegotiated on meat trade with Canada?
I think from the standpoint of the meat industry, we're more concerned about losses, if there'd be any kind of adverse reactions. Obviously, when you're at zero, you want to maintain zero, but, you know, there's been a lot of work done with our industry and as far as these supply chains to Mexico. We sell a lot of chilled product to Mexico. I think that there are some things here where, you know, if we look at TPP, and as Lighthizer said, that we would probably incorporate some things that were in TPP, maybe as we look at this. There was more science-based work. There was timeline set in TPP talking about dispute resolution. There were things here that if you're going to basically stop us from exporting to a country in TPP, you would basically have to produce the scientific evidence showing this, and this has not been the case thus far. So there's elements within the TPP agreement that we thought was basically renewing our negotiations with NAFTA and also Canada that would be very good to be incorporated. But as far as tariffs, duties, you can't improve on zero. But there were other areas when it came to dispute settlement, science-based trading, some of these types of things that could be incorporated that would even help facilitate trade more and have it be less trouble-free for all three countries.
Another point before we get to Janie's next question is that there were also some things that have been done since NAFTA as far as red meat trade with Canada and Mexico. It took us a long time to get access for all beef, all cattle, all ages to Mexico, to get ground beef access for Mexico. So it's not that everything to do with red meat trade was necessarily done at the time of NAFTA, but there have been a lot of gains for U.S. red meat over the past 20 years, and we definitely want to retain those as well. So, Janie, your next question.
Well, I mean, I think just looking at the case of Japan, as I said, we've enjoyed this kind of unique advantage right now because our main competitor in the Japanese marketplace, Australia, has had low cattle supplies. And that affects their pricing, their availability of product. But that's temporary. That's temporary. So what we're really worried about is 18 to 24 months from now, when they get back and can offer competitive prices and volumes on cuts that we now are supplying, but at duty rates that are double-digit lower than ours, that's that really will present us a handicap. So we're handicapped. Now, okay, we would have had TPP, we would have had to phase down in the duties, so that would have come over time, but right now, yeah, we're enjoying, but we're already looking beyond this, and we're not complacent at all. We see a threat in the future.
Brett Fordham from Inside U.S. Trade has a question. I'll repeat that question. It had to do with what, other than tariff reductions, what other gains were included in TPP that we would like to see incorporated in other agreements? Is that accurate? Okay. Phil, you want to take the first shot at that?
I think a couple of things, as I mentioned, on dispute resolution, that was something that if you're going to relegate someone out of a market for some scientific reason, you had to have scientific proof that you had to present to do this. And in all too often, we've seen instances where we've been relegated out of a market, but they don't have the scientific justification to do this. And so that's been an issue. So I think that's a vast improvement. On also on dispute resolution, for example, if there is an issue, it's time bound. There's provisions, for example, to when you want to form a panel, a scientific panel, it has to be done within a period of months, not a period of years. For the dispute to be rectified, it has to be done within a certain specific time frame. And so what we see is what you had in TPP was some very strong things that would, it was very trade progressive from the standpoint of not just lowering tariffs, but some of these other areas. And that's the stuff that could be included. I think one thing when we talk about TPP and why I think Joel and I both are very strong about taking a look at TPP is that looking at Australia, you know, they traditionally have cattle that are less expensive than the United States. They don't do as much grain feeding as we do. They might have a million head of cattle on feed at the max, but their currency, for example, is at about 75 cents compared to our dollar at this point in time, so they have an advantage with a currency that is not as strong as a dollar. And as Joel indicated, as time goes by, the current or the tariff goes down each year by about a percent, or a percent and a half, depending if it's chilled or frozen. But what this really means is that longer term, you see right now with the TPP 11, you have a situation where Australia and New Zealand have been very aggressive at trying to push this. As you know, Australia was the lead when it came to pushing for the meeting in Chile a couple months ago, and they've taken a very strong pro-trade stance. When we have to remember, when Australia negotiated their EPA with Japan, they negotiated alone, and they got 19% in an EPA that went on. In TPP, 11 countries negotiating with Japan was able to get the duty down to 9%. When we leave TPP, that was a bird in the hand. When we leave TPP, exit TPP, our duty went right back to 38.5%, and Australia is right now down to about 28%. So the longer this goes on, the more advantageous it is for Australia, and the less advantageous it is for the United States. So I think this is something that we really have to take a look at, because we're going right back to 38.5% duty. So if we could incorporate some of the market access provisions in TPP, this would be very helpful to the United States, especially the United States beef industry and agriculture in general.
Okay, we're going to turn to the reporters who are on the phone now. If you could please give us your name and your news outlet. If you have a question that's directed at any particular panelist, let us know who that is. Otherwise, the panel in general will take it. But can we take a first question from the phone, please?
Joe, this is Ron Hayes of Oklahoma City. And I guess my question is either for Phil or for Joel in regards to the status of the negotiations for the final protocol with China. Really interested in how you think we'll be able to solve both the transparency issue, the traceability issue, and any of the other aspects. I know what they're also talking about, wanting cattle 30 months of age or younger. Are all these things doable pretty quickly, you think?
I think they could hear Ron's question, but okay. The question had to do with beef access to China. Joel, do you want to go into some of the details there?
Yeah, sure. Well, as I mentioned before, I mean, the devil's in the details on what the protocol language is going to be. So for most countries that supply beef to China, there are these written protocols, and they spell out what the supplying country must comply with. And for our trading partners, traceability has been part of that. Some of the protocol language on traceability has been quite general. We await what specific language will be written in the protocol on traceability, and what it will specify or won't specify. Until we see that, it's just so difficult to say how the U.S. industry is going to organize itself to produce cattle and beef for China and how popular it'll become. I mean, in terms of those that want to adopt it. I mean, it's kind of a chicken and the egg question because, yeah, what's demand going to be? What's the price going to be? But until pricing can be put out to the importers, the extent to which China can incentivize our industry to produce more cattle according to their import conditions, that'll be unknown. But I will say this. I know there's been a lot of talk about China's no hormone and no beta agonist policy. Those laws have existed for since the early 2000s. So in speaking with importers last week, it's fairly transparent in terms of what ports may test for. So in China, so given that they have these zero tolerances for these compounds, I think our industry should expect that China will test our product when it hits the ports. To what extent they'll test, is it 100%, is it 5% of shipments, what kind of testing they'll use, I hope we'll know those details in the near future. Because again, those little details will determine the extent of this opportunity. I don't know if that's answering your question, but
as far as a 30-month of age,
and 30-month of age is, I think we've heard that's going to be a condition. But since they will be primarily interested in grain-fed choice prime select cuts, that shouldn't present too much of a problem in terms of our theoretical supply in the United States.
Right, almost all of the Fed slaughter is going to meet the 30-month requirement. Whether it meets the other requirements is another story,
right.
But the 30-month requirement is something we deal with in several of the
Asian
markets.
Yeah, we deal with it in other markets. Yeah, exactly.
Phil, do you have anything to add?
Well, no, I just think just looking at this over a span of time, I've seen two ways that we've negotiated in the past, and I'm not going to say which is the most successful, but a lot of times we've seen, for example, I can remember the 1984 Japan beef agreement. It was agreed to at a political level, and then the idea was, let's fill in the details later. And usually if you do it that way, the home field, the home country has the advantage because you've already reached an agreement at the political level, and so you just have to make it together. There's other agreements where you work it from the bottom up. So there's either a top-down or the bottom-up. You work out all the details first, and then you have the accord. So this one appears to be more at the political level. It's been agreed to. And right now, everyone is scrambling because of the Chinese suggestion of 100 days to resolve some of these issues. Now people are scrambling to fill in these details. And I think, sometimes in that sense of urgency, you can make mistakes, but I think that there's a very good team at the USDA, and I know industry is very close by. So, I'm confident that we should work out probably the best deal that we can get, but it's not the perfect deal.
Okay, thank you, Ron, for your question. Another question from reporters on the phone, please.
Yes, good morning. This is Colleen Schreiber with the negotiation process. But could you expound on yourself able to resolve the plant-based inspection process? We know something about that. Then secondly,
Colleen, we're having just a little bit of trouble hearing you. Could you speak up just a little bit?
Yeah, I'll take it off. I'll take it off my speaker. Is that any better?
That's much better. Thank you.
Okay. Have y'all been able to work out the plant-by-plant inspection process yet, or is that still to be determined? I'm assuming so. And then secondly, can you refresh us on when we were in China prior to being banned after BSC? I know that Joel said that the cuts, we need to expand our broaden our cuts. So what were we exporting into China prior to us being banned? And have they grown in terms of what they will take, or is it going to be an extremely price-sensitive market, like you said?
Okay, question again had to do with beef to China, asking about will plant-by-plant inspection be required, and do we expect the range of cuts to be wider than it was prior to the BSE closure, when that was when China was a rather small market for beef? Phil, you want to take that first?
Well, I think what I'd like to do is address the plant question, and then Joel will take the other one. I think that one of the major significant achievements of this past deal is the fact that China has agreed to abide by the 1999 agreement, which basically enhanced the principle of equivalency. And so what that means is the United States will remain and have a sovereignty over all our plants, which means that China will not be able to unilaterally say they wanted to list a plant in Iowa or Colorado or Nebraska. If there's an issue, China will talk to the United States. They'll talk to FSIS. We will do an investigation from our side, and it'll be up to FSIS to determine if the plant is eligible or not. So we've retained U.S. sovereignty over our plants, which is a very key and important principle for the United States when it comes to meat trade.
You know, on the cuts, yeah, it's a good question. Stimulates my memory. So before 2003, the U.S., well, China imported, it was a very low number of beef, but the U.S. had a high market share. It was just getting started. And at that time, our biggest item was what they call the short plate, which is like the belly. They sliced it, used it in hot pot. Like I said, it was just starting to roll into China. You know, fast forward to now, I mean, last year China imported 600,000 tons of beef from South America. They like the lean cuts. They like it because of the pricing. But on the U.S. side, that's the real question. What will we be able to export? So what we've been doing is we kind of been comparing it to Taiwan, because the consumer in Taiwan probably more closely resembles the average consumer in China. I hate to use the term average consumer because, like the United States, China has all these regional differences. But given the fact that there's so many large-scale chains flourishing now, and you'll see more similar menus throughout the country. For us, the key will be able to sell not only that the beef belly, but as many four-quarter cuts as we can. I think the hindquarter is going to be, the round cuts are going to be a little bit more challenging, because those are the items that are put in stews and lower-cost menu items, beef soups. And we would be competing with Brazil and Australian grass-fed on that. But I think a key question is how many of the four-quarter cuts can we sell? Middle meats, I don't think that's going to be a problem. Short plate, brisket, I think those will all go. But the more we can sell, the more competitive we'll be.
Okay, thank you, Colleen, for your question. Is there another question from a reporter on the phone, please? Okay, anyone here in the room have another question? That was Janie Gabbett from Meeting Place. She's asking if we have any concerns about the proposed USDA budgets. Phil, would you like to address that?
Well, yeah, I think that number one is, as you know, in the 1985 Farm Bill, they instituted the Target Export Assistance Program, and then there was the Market Promotion Program, and now we have the Market Access Program, and these are three different reincarnations. But the main thing was is that the aggressive nature of the competition that we're dealing with around the world, and also sometimes these unfair trade practices, are two reasons why we really need these programs. And if we take a look at Europe, Agrolytica did a study about a year and a half ago, and they produced a study that showed there's about $1.8 billion, if you look at the EU, with all the monies that are appropriated to help the EU become more aggressive internationally, more successful as an exporter. All these programs, and they take many, many, many manifestations, have been very significant, and that's why the EU, when they exited Russia, was able to go into Asia and do as well as they've done. We have tremendous competition that we're dealing with, and some of these issues we have to deal with as an industry. Individual companies cannot do that. So we feel it's critical that when we take a look at the market access program and the foreign market development program, that these programs are sustained, and because they have actually made a difference. I think all too often, a lot of people have given attribution to trade access, But you can have trade access to a market, but the only way you dignify these negotiations is with sound marketing programs, because most of these countries have competitors that are trying to supply it. And so this has been the difference in these markets where we're able to position the industry. If we wouldn't have had the market access program and some of these checkoff programs after the occurrence of BSE in this country, we wouldn't be enjoying the success we're having in Japan, in Korea, and Mexico without these programs. So they've been significant as far as our industry and also the other industries that are involved.
Okay, and Brett Fordham, you have a question. Question is about the EU beef dispute. We had a recent announcement that we may revisit retaliatory measures in that dispute and what we expect to happen over the next few months. Phil, do you want to address that?
Yes, I think this is something that's very much on everyone's mind is the EU trade, and I think it's symbolic that, you know, that when the fact that we've won two cases in the WTO, the retaliation, we thought with the 2009 agreement we were making progress. When we dropped the retaliation in exchange for 38,000 metric tons of duty-free access, the problem associated with that, of course, is, as you all know, that many of our competitors who maybe don't really meet the grain-fed guidelines that we thought were in that agreement have really been doing very well. And so the United States has basically been losing market share as a result of this, and this is something that we can't sustain. So we have expressed this to our government both before, obviously, the election, after the election, and after the inauguration. And I think that we are very, very close to seeing maybe some type of commitment by our government to move on this. But obviously, we haven't had all the players in place. But this is something that we're continuing to press forward with our government as far as beef access to the European Union.
Okay. I'll put out one last call for a final question. Does anybody here in the room or on the phone have a final question for the panel?
I have hopefully a quick question if I could. I'm Barbara in Omaha. I'm just wondering, please, I haven't heard any talk about whether the access to China is duty-free, or could you describe any tariff structure that's being discussed?
Could you start your question again, please? I'm sorry, we had just had a little trouble hearing you.
Sure. The question is just, what tariff structure or are we talking about with the China access? Is it duty-free for a certain volume?
Joel, do you want to take that? I believe China's basic tariff on beef imports is 12%. And then we're also looking at a kind of a value-added tax.
13%.
So if you could go into some of those details.
Yeah, so we assume at the moment that the duty won't change. And as Joe said, chilled and frozen beef import duty is 12%. All agricultural imports are assessed a further 13% value-added tax on the customs cleared price. So it brings up the price of the product once it gets through to close to 30%.
The only beef supplier to China right now that has a significant advantage in that area would be New Zealand, because they've had a FTA in place with China for quite some time, so they're almost duty free. Australia's FTA is fairly new, so I think they're down around 9%. So we're not facing huge disadvantages there, but you know, obviously, you do. It is a barrier in terms of price, but there's not a tremendous advantage for anyone other than New Zealand.
That 13% is that an additional or total?
Yeah, no, it's 13% on the customs cleared price. So if it's a dollar, then it's $1.12, and then it's 13% of the $1.12.
But even a beef supplier that has an FTA isn't going to escape the value-added tax. Yeah, that stays even for everyone. Any final questions before we close the call? Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us. If you have any follow-up, you have my contact information. Please call or text me, and I'll do my best to get you a follow-up answer.